This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Listeners plus stream online. So it's a very powerful tool, but this is a one-shot opportunity. So we want folks to get involved. And you can sign up with us if you want to start a station yourself or if you want to support others to expand independent media. Of course, many of the low-power FM stations on the air today broadcast Democracy Now!, and this is a platform to keep producing local coverage, local news, and also to open up space for more outlets like Democracy Now!, for more Amy's and Juan's to pop up all over the country, get that kind of training, and really transform the media. But it's a one-time chance.
And Ramon, quickly, the impact that this has had on your organizing in Oregon?
Well, we've been able to use it as a mobilizing tool. You know, Oregon just recently, for example, was one of those states that reinstated driver's license for undocumented workers in the state of Oregon. Major, major victory. How did we do that? Well, part of it, the radio had to do with it. We mobilized thousands of people, and we asked the people in our rallies who attended committee hearings, how did you hear about this? Radio Movimiento. That's how we got here. So it's a powerful tool. It's benefited us, and we want to be able to share that with other community organizations, because prior to us having this radio, we didn't know anything.
We have to leave it there, but we'll certainly continue to follow this issue. Jeff Rousset with Prometheus Radio Project, Ramon Ramirez with PECUN, the largest Latino organization in Oregon. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Fels, Sarah Monte, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Ravi Karan, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, I'm Amy Goodman, Wu Juan Gonzalez, thanks for joining us.
It's 5:01. The PM News is next, and you are listening to KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Dr. Robert Amajoy and the Northwest Center for Colorectal Health, LLC, providing screening colonoscopy to help prevent colorectal cancer, as well as minimally invasive management of colorectal disease. Offices in Portland and Milwaukee. Detailed information at 503-216-5380 or nwcch.com.
Peace, this is Mike Crenshaw. I want to invite you to come out to see Long Distance Revolutionary, a documentary about Mumia Abu-Jamal. This film chronicles his life as a revolutionary, a writer, a journalist, a philosopher, and an inspiration to people worldwide. It's showing June 14th at the Clinton Street Theater. That's a Friday night.
At 7 p.m.
That starts the week-long run of Long Distance Revolutionary in Portland. KBOO is proud to bring you this event, and I hope to see you there.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the third annual 2013 Closer Electronic Music Festival, which starts June 20th. Closer PDX is hosting this cutting-edge electronic music and dance festival with an unparalleled selection of local and regional talent and labels. The Closer Electronic Music Festival is being held on the inner sides of East and West Portland at many different venues. From the kickoff at Crush on June 20th to the Closer at Selwood Riverfront on June 23rd, there will be more than 50 performers and special guests. More information and tickets for this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council approves its 2013-14 city budget.
Oregon Supreme Court upholds Governor Kitzhaber's reprieve on inmate execution in the Gary Haugen case.
And local activists organize in solidarity with protesters in Brazil.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening Newscast for Thursday, June 20th, 2013. I'm Jen Chavez.
And I'm Joey G. As expected, Portland City Council voted almost unanimously to pass its 2013-2014 city budget this afternoon. Amanda Fritz, the one dissenting voice, voiced concern over cuts to social services. The city will eliminate the Office of Healthy Working Rivers and cut hundreds of thousands of dollars from various homeless aid and environmental aid programs. City Commissioners Dan Saltzman and Nick Fish both told the Oregonian that the budget was the harshest they'd ever considered. Regardless, the current budget will only require 26 layoffs versus 170, as previously expected. The Buckman Pool, Mounted Patrol, some community schools, domestic violence, and human trafficking aid, and youth shelters were among the programs that were spared despite early projections. Some cuts were avoided in part due to a county funding deal Mayor Hales worked out with Multnomah County Board Chairman Jeff Cogan. Though the city avoided public safety sector layoffs, early retirement offers in the police bureau was still reduced staffing.
As we reported on last night's news, a group of protesters gathered yesterday outside City Hall in Portland to try to persuade commissioners to keep fighting a federal regulation that requires Portland's reservoirs be covered. The Occupy movement joined the fight to preserve Portland's reservoirs and helped organize yesterday's protest. They're also planning an event at Mount Tabor on July 12th. Longtime Portland water activist Kent Crawford said he welcomes the addition of the Occupy movement's energy into the struggle to preserve Portland's pristine water supply.
In January, then, Water Commissioner Steve Novick sent a letter to the Oregon Health Authority requesting a reprieve from the EPA mandate to cover or replace Portland's open drinking water reservoirs. That request for reprieve was later denied by the Oregon Health Authority, and subsequent to that, Mayor Hales and three members of the City Council decided to discontinue pursuing any relief from the state from the EPA reservoir mandate. We think that's the wrong decision. We don't think it's the time to wave the white flag over Portland's historic open reservoirs. They're perfectly well-functioning. They've served us well for 123 years. There's been no documented health threats associated with them. And we really don't need to spend $300 million to replace something that isn't broken. So we'd like to see the city continue fighting. Unfortunately, Mayor Hales is waving the white flag and capitulating to the EPA. But we'd like to see him in City Hall fight. And if he won't, then ratepayers are prepared to take matters into their own hands, and that's one of the reasons why we're initiating a ballot initiative to convert Portland's Water Bureau into an independent people's utility district.
Crawford also pointed out that the city of New York managed to get a variance for their drinking water, which also comes from a pristine source.
You know, Mayor Michael Bloomberg has been a strong advocate for New York's drinking water. He's fought aggressively against these EPA mandates. You know, he's worked hard with his congressional delegation and with the state of New York to seek a reprieve for New York's open reservoir, and that work has paid off. New York has been granted a reprieve. Charlie Hales, on the other hand, is a former engineering company executive. He's pretty much caved in at his first opportunity. You know, he says he's on the side of ratepayers, on the side of neighborhoods, but he really hasn't lifted a finger to try and protect Portland's open reservoirs. He could have appealed this spring to Governor Kitzhaber personally to weigh in and grant Portland a reprieve for its open reservoirs. Mayor Hales did not do that, and his inaction is what allowed the state to turn down Portland's deferral request and sentence us to a $300 million make-work project that we don't need. The governor could stop this right now. With his signature and the stroke of a pen, John Kitzhaber could save Portland's open reservoirs today. The problem is, the city of Portland needs to be asking him to do that. The leadership at Portland City Hall needs to be asking him to do that. Mayor Charlie Hales needs to be personally appealing to the governor to save our open reservoirs. The mayor has not done that. He needs to. And we need to make sure that the message is clear from ratepayers and neighborhoods and others, very clear to Mayor Hales, that he needs to make the overture. He needs to make the request. He needs to champion our open drinking water reservoirs. And if he doesn't, his silence is deafening. And if he fails to do it, then that's why we think ratepayers need to take matters into their own hands. We need to take control of the Portland Water Bureau away from City Hall, bring it back closer to the people affected, closer to ratepayers, and we think this PUD initiative is the best way to do that.
That was longtime Portland Water activist Kent Crawford. Occupy Mount Tabor will be held on Friday, July 12th. More information can be found on the Facebook page Occupy Mount Tabor or on the website friendsofreservoirs.org.
Yesterday, the Xerxes Society for Invertebrate Conservation reported the death of approximately 25,000 bumblebees in Wilsonville, Oregon, the largest known incident of bumblebee deaths in the United States. The bumblebees, along with honeybees and ladybugs, were found dead as early as Monday in the local Target parking lot. An investigation into the use of pesticides is being led by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Initial tests suggest a pesticide called Safari had been sprayed onto the 55 blooming European linden trees adorning the lot. Safari belongs to the neonicotinoid family of pesticides. Its application causes the flowers, leaves, and nectar of a plant to become toxic to all insects. Elliott Associate Incorporated manages the Argyle Square property. If an investigation shows Elliott Associates Incorporated violated any state or federal pesticide regulations, the company could face fines that range from $1,000 to $10,000.
According to an analysis by the online foreclosure database Realty Track, 28% of foreclosed homes in Oregon are vacant, despite still belonging to their original owners. About 1,100 of Oregon's 3,900 homes currently in foreclosure are empty. Oregon is now second only to Indiana in the percentage of foreclosed homes that are unoccupied and unmaintained. The foreclosure process has been lengthening in recent years due to changes in state law and legal actions surrounding many foreclosure proceedings. While many lenders have postponed sales of foreclosed homes due to the longer process, many homeowners are still under the impression that they will be kicked out quickly once the foreclosure process begins. Whether a home is occupied or not, the original owner is responsible for utilities, taxes, and maintenance until it is sold. Before a home is resold, a lender may be reluctant to move in and perform upkeep due to concerns about trespassing charges and other legal problems. Empty homes are leading to increasingly derelict vacant properties that are magnets for squatters and criminal activity. A recent state law, HB 2662, or the Good Neighbor Bill, gives local governments the right to perform basic maintenance on vacant foreclosures and requires lenders to post contact information on empty homes.
A significant number of layoffs will be coming to the Oregonian as its parent company, Advance Publications, restructures local operations. For now, the Oregonian will still publish on the same schedule, not the reduced three-day-per-week format used by the Time-Picayune of New Orleans. Changes at this newspaper, founded in 1850, were reported online while Oregonian employees commented on Twitter. The number of employees who will keep their jobs with the new operating companies, Oregonian Media Group or Advanced Central Services Oregon, is unknown. A staff member commented on Twitter mentions a significant number of layoffs as Advanced Publications seek to maintain or maximize profits and CEO salaries. Advanced Publications owns Conde Nast and papers in more than 25 American cities. During a strike beginning in 1959, Oregonian workers established a paper of their own that was published until October 1964.
In the Oregon State Legislature in Salem today, Democrats and Republicans continued to hash out potential cuts to public employee benefits in relation to potential tax increases to try to reach a compromise on the state budget for the next year. In the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee this afternoon, the discussion centered around a $150 million tax break for certain business owners. The Senate Republicans did not budge on their demand that these tax cuts be included in this year's budget bill. Meanwhile, in the Senate Emergency Preparedness Task Force hearing, Michael Stewart of the Portland Water Bureau talked about how vulnerable Portland's water systems are to earthquakes and other disasters.
I wanted to talk to you for a minute about why water and wastewater systems are so vulnerable. It's somewhat like the energy systems. Tsunamis nail us because we tend to be in low spots, and we've got pipes and treatment facilities everywhere, particularly the sewer systems. They tend to be run by gravity, and the low spot is along the river or along the coast, so the treatment plants and so on tend to be in the places you might least like them to be from the respect of a seismic event. Shaking, we have very rigid facilities, and they don't do well with shaking. Ground deformation, landslides, earthquakes, and something called lateral spread that's not listed, basically drag the pipes and make them all pull apart. So the systems themselves are hugely vulnerable. They're very large. They're very complex. I'm the chief engineer of the Portland Water Bureau. We cut a 35-mile swath of Portland, of the north coast area, and we go from the mountains to down beside the river and up into the next mountain range. We hit every kind of topography. We've got pipes basically running under every street, as do the sewer systems. We have them running alongside rivers, liquefaction zones, and so on, and down into the coastal area. Location matters a great deal in the kind of damage that you get in an earthquake. We're also uniquely vulnerable because we're very dependent upon all of the other what are called lifeline sectors, energy in particular. Energy I usually think of as electricity, and I would particularly mention fuel. I think you've been briefed on that. Fuel is a very, very big deal in our state. We don't have enough of it, and we don't have it distributed very well, and we can't move it around very well. But we must rely on all of those things to operate our water systems. We need electricity to run the pumping plants, treatment plants. We use a lot of fiber optic cable, which is in duct banks, which are very much like pipes, to actually control these systems, and so on.
That was testimony from an Oregon Congressional Task Force on Emergency Preparedness in the state, held today in the state capitol in Salem.
Also today in the state legislature, a work session was held on a bill requiring the Department of Veterans Affairs to create and coordinate public information campaign to prevent suicide by veterans. The bill directs the department to conduct outreach to cities, counties, community organizations, persons, and organizations to provide service and assistance to veterans. It would create a public information campaign to prevent veteran suicides and provide information and services to veterans about veterans' benefits. Senator Betsy Johnson from Scappoose voted some concern that the providers should be properly qualified to deal with veterans considering suicide.
My question has to do with the plethora of initiatives that are working on this very serious subject, and the fact that I hope this session provides money that actually mans or woman's a suicide line. I am particularly concerned that, in my opinion, doing suicide prevention is no place for amateurs. And I know that there is one organization in Oregon, Lines for Life, that has a national accreditation that may not be held by other organizations. And what I'm trying to figure out is that if we do a public information campaign about suicide prevention, I'm very supportive of that. How do we know that we are directing people to properly funded, properly staffed, properly trained people that will deal with persons that are in enormous crisis? It's great to tell them to call someplace. What do they get when they call? That's really what I'm looking for.
So co-chairs, members of the committee, co-chair Johnson, great questions. And I think the funding for any of that larger discussion would be largely separate from this bill. There's certainly no intent out of 762 for ODBA to staff a crisis line, and it wouldn't be our expertise. but we can partner with the organizations, whether Lines for Life, whether through the federal VA, and Lines for Life is the overflow for the federal VA line. Often it is a direction, you know, it's that crisis management, but also a direction to direct services, whether at the county or state level, that they're referring folks to in that time of crisis.
Well, I guess this is more, Mr. Chair, by your leave, I guess this is more rhetorical than anything else. I just hope the legislative body is, first of all, generous in funding this, I think, particularly given our Iraq and Afghanistan veterans coming back. It is a national shame that we have the men and women who have worn the uniform of this country finding themselves in such despair that they take their own lives. But I hope we're generous, and I hope that we are cautious in picking providers with the requisite experience and infrastructure to actually be that bridge back to life for somebody who is in such extremis that they would feel compelled to call a line for life to bridge them through that personal despair.
That was Oregon Senator Betsy Johnson from Scappoose. The work session on the bill today did not result in a vote, although the bill may still be considered for a vote before the end of the legislative session later this month.
Also in the state legislature, the Oregon State Senate passed today a bill giving the Department of Consumer and Business Services, or DCBS, further power to hold insurance companies accountable when they break the law. The bill was sparked by complaints against health insurers from parents of autistic children, but it will apply to all lines of insurance in the state. SB 414A allows the DCBS to force an insurance company to pay restitution when consumers suffer damages due to insurance code violations. The insurance code is a set of laws that regulates the industry. The bill does not allow individuals to seek personal action against insurers. They may only do so through the DCBS. Last year, the DCBS processed 3,228 consumer complaints against insurance companies. The bill now goes to the State House of Representatives for consideration.
A local nonprofit has won over $1 million grant from the Department of Labor to assist incarcerated people in transitioning out of prison and into education or employment. The Department of Labor announced the grant to local nonprofit SE Works on Southeast Foster Road as one of 16 grants awarded to prisoner reentry programs around the country, totaling in over $20 million. The Scanner reports that a Seattle nonprofit, Pioneer Human Services, is also on that list. SE Works, which aims to help prisoners find jobs after being released from incarceration, reportedly served 16,000 people last year.
Today, the Oregon Supreme Court upheld Governor John Kitzhaber's temporary reprieve of death row inmate Gary Haugen. Haugen had rejected the reprieve, insisting he had a legal right to be executed by the state. Kitzhaber wants to reevaluate and reform the Oregon justice system's use of capital punishment, which he says is unworkable and, quote, fails to meet the basic standards of justice. Chief Justice Thomas Ballmer concluded that the reprieve of Haugen was valid and overturned a decision by the Marion County Circuit Court last year. Haugen is a twice-convicted murderer and the first person to waive his right to appeal the death penalty since Oregon's last execution in 1997, which incidentally occurred during Kitzhaber's first term as governor.
Lawyers in Texas are fighting to halt the state's 500th execution. The Lone Star State outstrips all American states in execution since the federal reinstatement of the death penalty in 1976. 52-year-old Kimberly McCarthy was convicted of murder in 1997 by a Dallas County court and sentenced to death by lethal injection. McCarthy is the ex-wife of new Black Panther Party founder Aaron Michaels. Her execution is scheduled for next Wednesday. Moore 11, McCarthy's legal counsel, filed a motion to stay her execution that alleges McCarthy, a Black woman, was the victim of a racially biased trial. She was convicted of murdering her white neighbor. Levin's motion additionally claims McCarthy was provided with poor legal counsel during her trial and the appeals process. 23% of Dallas's county population is Black, and yet 12 out of 13 jurors in McCarthy trial were white. Levin says that the verdict reflects a history of racially based jury selection in Dallas County, which includes a 1963 manual for prosecutors discouraging them from accepting minority jurors. A 1986 manual advises prosecutors to avoid potential jurors with, quote, multiple gold chains around their necks or those who would appear to be free thinkers. None of McCarthy's lawyers challenged the racially distorted jury composition.
Today brought more mass protests in Brazil, despite government promises to rescind the 20-cent bus fare increase that initially sparked the uproar. Holding signs that read, "This isn't about the 20 cents," hundreds of thousands of protesters filled the streets in dozens of cities, including Sao Paulo. Vanessa Giacometti, a Portland resident or originally from Brazil, is the daughter of a prominent student activist who opposed the Brazilian dictatorship in the 1960s. She spoke with KBOO's Jenka Soderberg about the protests in Brazil and a solidarity protest planned for this Saturday in Portland's Pioneer Courthouse Square.
Not being covered on the major media, and it's hard to get information about what's actually going on the ground.
Right now, the problem that we are facing, it's a big fight against the corruption. Things started in the very beginning with a group of students and population from some major cities in Brazil. They were against the raise on the public transportation price. And we have a very poor public transportation system. So this is a movement that's going on for years, but they combined with other groups. They got together because enough is enough. The government is corrupted. We are facing a World Cup that will probably going to happen next year. The amount of money spent on our stadiums were money that they could invest in health, education, and public transportation. But the money is going to still be in the hands of the powerful ones. It started with the 20 cents rise for the public transportation, but it ended up gathering people from all over saying that enough is enough of corruption. Right now, what we are fighting for and people are seeing on TV is that we arrived at a point that we can't stand anymore paying taxes and having nothing in return. So why can't we have a good public system? Why can't we have a good public transportation, education, basic needs for the population, but on the other hand, the government can spend billions of dollars in refurbishing or building stadiums for the World Cup or the Olympics just to show the world an image that is not the reality of Brazil.
Does it seem like there are similarities with the Occupy Wall Street movement? Are people talking about the disparity in the cost of living between the very rich and the rest of the population?
Yes. In Brazil, you would be shocked if you're in the street and then you can see a poor kid next to your car asking for some money in a traffic light, like when you stop there, and a guy driving a BMW. So the contrast that was the expectations that we were, or the people were putting on those guys that participated in the movement during the dictatorship movement, fighting for democracy, for real democracy, we're not seeing it now because the gap is too big. It's a huge contrast. You see people that are really wealthy and people that go to bed without food. But what happened is that that the pot boiled over, and people are still going to the streets.
Well, thanks so much. Again, I've been speaking with Vanessa Giacometti, who is a local Brazilian activist here in Portland. That solidarity protest will be on Saturday, beginning at 1:30 at Pioneer Courthouse Square in downtown Portland. I'm Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio news after this newscast, followed by Wisdom of the Elders at 6, Wisdom and Culture from Native American Elders. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a small chance of showers and a high near 68 degrees. Tomorrow night will be partly cloudy with lows dropping to around 54. And the summer solstice arrives tonight at 10:02 p.m.
The time is 5:30. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Harold's Hardware, located near my home in Austin, Texas, is the opposite of a big box chain store. It's an unchained, small box store with a knowledgeable staff willing to help customers figure out how to do most any project. Harold's slogan is, "Together, we can do it yourself." I borrowed that rich concept for a commencement speech I recently laid on high school graduates in my hometown of Denison, Texas. Like most commencement droners, I urged the bright kids in funny square hats to do big things in life. But my message was that bigness cannot be measured in terms of personal wealth and self-aggrandizement, even though such narcissism is the ethic being preached and practiced by today's corporate and political elite. Rather, only by joining with others in democratic actions can any of us achieve something bigger than ourselves, something for the betterment of the whole community. As Bill Moyers noted in an earlier speech, civilization is not just what happens, it is what we make happen. The key word there is we, for no I is big enough to do the job. But together, as Harold's Hardware says, we can do it. The proof of this was sitting right in front of me at the graduation ceremonies. When I was in their place in 1961, every single person in my class and the audience was a white Anglo. Our schools and town were totally segregated. On this night, though, the ceremony was a glory of Anglo, African, Latino, Arab, Asian, and other ancestries. This is Jim Hightower saying, Denison became a better, more civilized place only because so many people, including some of the grayheads in this audience, had dared to stand together to make it happen. The class of 2013 applauded this ethic of social progress, and they gave me hope that we can pull our country together again. E pluribus unum.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Alan Chambers, head of the Gay Conversion Ministry Exodus International, has formally shut down the organization after publicly admitting that he still feels same-sex attraction and that reparative therapy is ineffective and damaging. He also called on Christian churches to be open and accommodating to gays and lesbians, writing, quote, "From a Judeo-Christian perspective, gay, straight, or otherwise, we're all prodigal sons and daughters. Exodus International is the prodigal's older brother, trying to impose its will on God's promises and makes judgment on who's worthy of his kingdom. God is calling us to be the Father, to welcome everyone, to love unhindered," end quote. Churches affiliated with Exodus International that had been running autonomously will continue to offer the controversial therapy.
A 33-year-old journalist who died in a fatal car accident this week contacted WikiLeaks just hours before his death, according to the group's attorney. Journalist Michael Hastings gained widespread fame for his Rolling Stone magazine interview of General Stanley McChrystal. McChrystal made negative comments about the Obama administration during that interview, which eventually led to the general's resignation. On Monday, just hours before Hastings' tragic death in Los Angeles in a single car accident, he spoke to a WikiLeaks employee on the phone. The content of that conversation has not been revealed. Hastings' colleague, Cenk Uygur, said that Hastings had become a nervous wreck who was convinced that the FBI was after him due to his controversial work. Hastings traveled extensively in the Middle East and reported for Rolling Stone magazine, often writing stories that highlighted corruption at the highest levels of U.S. leadership.
Today, the U.S. House of Representatives passed an amendment to H.R. 1947. The Federal Agriculture Reform and Risk Management Act of 2013, or the Farm Bill, that would block federal interference in college and university industrial hemp research in states where hemp is already legal. Democratic Representatives Jared Polis of Colorado and Errol Blumenauer of Oregon joined Republican Thomas Massey of Kentucky in proposing the amendment. The vote was 225-200. KBOO's Red and Green spoke with Representative Blumenauer, Communications Director Thomas Malone, for more.
What is the significance of the hemp research amendment to H.R. 1947?
Well, we're dealing with a situation where hemp is an important agricultural commodity. U.S. retailers sell over $300 million worth of goods containing hemp every year. All of that hemp is imported. The U.S. farmers are not allowed to grow it. Now, what this amendment does is it allows colleges and universities to grow and cultivate industrial hemp for research purposes so they can further study it and see how it is, can be used effectively as an industrial crop and grown in the U.S. in a safe and responsible way. It's sort of a good first step to normalizing hemp and showing how it can be a big part of American economy with no risk to anybody.
And hemp and marijuana are not the same.
They're not the same. They're related, which is basically why hemp gets a bad name. But hemp is not a drug. It does not have significant levels of THC where people could use it for drug purposes.
And how does this bill guarantee that the federal government will not prosecute research institutions?
Well, this amendment would actually change the federal law by amending the Farm Bill. So that would make sure that the federal government would not come in and crack down on that.
And industrial hemp is not legally allowed to be grown in every single state in the United States, correct?
Correct. Correct, under federal law.
What was Representative Blumenauer's role in getting this amendment passed?
Well, we have actually been working on a variety of marijuana and hemp legislation and amendments since the beginning of this Congress in an attempt to get federal policy, state policy on the same page. You have now more than 20 states and the District of Columbia in some way legalizing marijuana, mostly for medical purposes, but for some adult recreational use in Washington State, Colorado. So the tide is really turning, but people in the states, even where medical marijuana is allowed under state law, have this fear of federal prosecution. So Congressman Blumenauer, along with Congressman Polis from Colorado, have been taking the lead to say the federal government needs to let states make their own decisions on these issues, on marijuana and also on hemp, which is related and gets grouped in with marijuana, even though they are for very different purposes.
Representatives Polis and Blumenauer were joined by Republican Thomas Massey of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Is it notable that it's a bipartisan effort?
I think so. I think you're seeing with a lot of hemp, people saying, wait, this is just getting grouped in inappropriately. People need more education about hemp. They need to understand that this is really a cash crop where the U.S. is just giving money away by buying it from other countries instead of growing it here. You're going to see a lot of Republicans who understand that once they're educated about the issue. It really just becomes about the science and business of it instead of any preconceived notions that they have. A lot of the marijuana work that they are doing as well, Congressman Blumenauer and Polis have bipartisan support because it's not only a right of personal liberty or in a right of people who are suffering with chronic illness or pain relief, but you also get a very strong states' rights feeling going on here, where states are saying, if our voters have voted on it and said we want this, why is the federal prohibition overriding our choice state? And I think that that's an argument that resonates with a lot of Republicans, and you're going to see more and more Republicans and more people on both sides of the aisle come to this understanding over the next years. I mean, the tide is really turning here on marijuana legislation, also hemp.
That was Patrick Malone, Communications Director for Representative Blumenhauer in Washington, D.C. I'm Ren Green for KBOO News.
Today in Washington, Democrat opposition to spending cuts helped defeat the House Farm Bill, 234-188. The Farm Bill has been in contention for a year due to conservative insistence on deeper spending cuts, though a Senate version passed last month. The proposed budget would have trimmed farm and nutrition expenditures by $40 billion over the next decade. $5 billion in direct farmer subsidies would have disappeared. Food stamp cuts were at the heart of the farm bill debate, as Republicans wanted to prune the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, by $20.5 billion. Democratic lawmakers were concerned about the 2 million Americans who could have lost food stamp benefits under the bill. The Obama administration would not support the House bill due to both farmer subsidy and deep food stamp cuts. $9 billion in farmer subsidy savings would have been channeled into a crop insurance program. Democratic Representative Jim McGovern of Massachusetts led a coalition that introduced an amendment restoring SNAP benefits to Americans in need by slashing crop insurance. According to the New York Times, McGovern said, quote, "The price of a farm bill should not be making more people hungry in America," end quote.
Earlier today, two Senate Republicans and the bipartisan Gang of Eight reached a deal in hopes of gaining support for immigration legislation through heightened border security. According to the New York Times, the deal, drafted by Senators Bob Corker of Tennessee and John Hoeven of North Dakota, called for a border surge. The proposed border surge would double the Border Patrol force from 21,000 agents to 40,000 while adding 700 miles of fence to the southern border. Senators Corker and Hoeven drafted the proposal as an alternative to an amendment recently proposed by fellow Republican Senator John Cornyn. Senator Cornyn's amendment included a 90% trigger, which would have postponed amnesty for illegal immigrants until the border search security achieved a 90% apprehension rate. The opposition to Cornyn's proposal called his amendment a poison pill. Despite the agreement reached today, the immigration bill is far from complete. The Guardian notes that another 278 amendments await debate before a proposed Senate vote on the full bill 4th of July.
A 6-2 decision in the U.S. Supreme Court today found that groups working to stop the AIDS crisis abroad cannot be required by the government to be anti-prostitution or anti-sex worker to receive federal funds. The decade-old Leadership Against HIV, AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria Act, put in place under the Bush administration, has produced many successes and over $60 billion in aid. But prior to today, federal law required aid groups that want to access these funds for HIV and AIDS prevention work in other countries to overtly pledge opposition to prostitution and sex work. Many aid workers and advocates felt the law limited their potential impact on some of the most stigmatized and high-risk populations. Today, I spoke with Sarah Sipple, president of the Center for Health and Gender Equity, or CHANGE, who explained the implications of the ruling. Previous to today's Supreme Court decision, what kind of obstacles did advocacy groups trying to aid sex worker populations affected by HIV and AIDS face?
Well, I think it was not only advocacy organizations that were impacted by the so-called anti-prostitution loyalty oath, but also actually, you know, service providers, the organizations that were actually doing HIV prevention programs on the ground that were seeking to reach sex workers. And I think the most important impact was that when working with sex workers, a very marginalized population, trust is really an important aspect to that work for the health workers to actually reach the sex workers, to give them information and services around HIV. And without that trust, that population can't be reached. And this is a population that's really at high risk of HIV infections. So not being able to build that trust means that it really impacted their ability to reach them. It meant for some groups eliminating services, others really downsizing the kind of programs that they would do, like drop-in centers where sex workers could go during the day for nutrition, for to use the bathroom, for education, things. So those are the kinds of support services that have really suffered, have declined because of this policy.
And what was the legal basis for the majority ruling in the Supreme Court in regards to this policy?
This was a First Amendment case, and the finding, the opinion was really about, you know, can the U.S. government require a recipient of U.S. funding to adopt the viewpoint of the U.S. government as a condition for aid? And the decision, the 6-2 decision, came down on that the U.S. government cannot use that as a condition for aid.
In light of today's decision, how do you foresee work in this field expanding?
Well, I think the most important piece of this is that for the U.S. organizations, that it frees them up to really be innovative and to be free in discussions around the HIV prevention efforts that are directed towards sex workers. And I think it's important, and it goes back to this being a freedom of speech issue, that now the anti-prostitution loyalty oath is no longer stands in the way of really the discussion, the independent thinking, the innovative spirit necessary to find an end to the AIDS epidemic. So this is, it really frees up public health experts and providers the freedom they need to do their jobs effectively. The decision really impacts U.S. groups only. That's what we're very clear about. And I think there's still a question, though, on how is it going to impact the international, the non-U.S. organizations that get sub-grants through these U.S. organizations.